This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert McNamara, who is considered the architect of the war in Vietnam, died early today at the age of 93. We're going to listen back to a 1995 interview with him and an interview with Errol Morris about his movie The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara. Let me quote the New York Times McNamara obituary by Tim Weiner. Quote, Robert McNamara was perhaps the most influential defense secretary of the 20th century. He helped lead the nation into the maelstrom of Vietnam and spent the rest of his life wrestling with the war's moral consequences. Serving President John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson from 1961 to 68, McNamara oversaw hundreds of military missions, thousands of nuclear weapons, and billions of dollars in military spending and foreign arms sales. 500,000 American soldiers went to war on his watch. More than 16,000 died. 42,000 more would fall in the 7 years to come. The war in Vietnam became his personal nightmare. He concluded well before leaving the Pentagon that the war was futile, but he did not share that insight with the public until late in life. In 1995, he took a stand against his own conduct of the war, confessing in a memoir that it was wrong, terribly wrong. Unquote from Tim Weiner's obituary. Here's an excerpt of the interview I recorded with Robert McNamara when that 1995 memoir was published. In the interview, he refers to Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State during the years McNamara was Secretary of Defense. I asked McNamara if he saw his book as an apology.
Some people have used redemption, apology. Forget redemption and apology and say that I think those of us, assuming for the minute I'm correct, as I say in the preface, I believe it was an error, a tragic error. Assume for the minute that my judgment is correct, then I think we owe an explanation to future generations of what happened and how to avoid that in the future. That's the purpose of the book.
To explain.
To explain, and more than explain, to draw lessons and suggest how to prevent similar tragedies in the future.
Do you think an apology is appropriate?
Well, if you want me to apologize, of course, but that's not the issue. The issue isn't apology. You don't I'll call it correct a wrong by apologizing. You can correct a wrong only if you understand how it occurred and you take steps to ensure it won't happen again.
Let me ask you about the anti-war movement. I think some of the conclusions that you reach in your memoir about the war, why the war was unwinnable and why it was a mistake, leaders of the peace movement were saying for many years, for example, that the communist threat wasn't as great as it was represented to be, that the North Vietnamese, even though they had a small and low-tech army, had strong nationalistic feelings and a will to keep fighting, and then that would inspire them to just keep pushing. I'm wondering if you listened to the peace movement at all, or if you shut it out and just thought, you know, they're wrong and I'm not going to pay any attention to what they're saying.
Now, I listened to the peace movement. One of the close friends of my middle child, a daughter, organized and led thousands of individuals to march on Washington, demonstrate against the president, against me. My daughter, several occasions, brought him home to dinner after that. On one occasion, after dinner, we went into the library. We talked until 10:30. As he left, his last words, very serious, were, "No man can be all bad who loves the mountains as much as you do." I listened to the protesters. I had them in my home. So that's one point. Now, the second point, you have to understand where we came from. And many of the protesters had not. President Kennedy, Dean Rusk, and I, and many others of us, had fought in World War II. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Churchill said millions of men lost their lives in that war because the West reacted too late to Hitler's menace to the security of Western Europe. And by God, says Churchill, we should never do that again. Just after that war, the Soviet Union took control of Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia. After that, in my period, in August of 1961, the Soviet Union sought to take Berlin. General, I called Norstad, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, to my office. I asked him how we would have to react. He said, you may well have to use nuclear weapons. This was a dangerous world. A year later, Khrushchev put nuclear missiles into Cuba. To this day, the American public doesn't know how close we came to nuclear war. In June of 67, the Egyptians vowed to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. The Israelis learned of it in advance. They attacked Egypt, knocked the hell out of them, hit Jordan as well. Kosygin used the hotline for the first time, the Soviet prime minister, to Johnson, said, if you want war, you'll get it. It was a dangerous world. That was driving us to our action in Vietnam. We were wrong. The protesters turned out, with hindsight, to be right. We didn't believe it at the time.
You raise the question in your book, you know, why didn't you and other government officials spend more time on questions that seriously challenged some of the rationales of the war? And you write, readers must wonder, readers of your memoir, must wonder how presumably intelligent, experienced officials failed to address questions whose answers so deeply affected the lives of our citizens and the welfare of our nation. An orderly, rational approach was precluded by the crowding out, which resulted from the fact that Vietnam was but one of a multitude of problems we confronted.
Let me digress just a second to say I signed a contract to write an autobiography. And when I presented the book proposal to publishers, I outlined how I was going to do it, and I had a section on the Defense Department. I was there 7 years. Vietnam was just one of 100 problems, if you will, we were dealing with at that time. I didn't mention one, the Bay of Pigs, which occurred within 90 days after. It was a total debacle. Then we faced Berlin, then we faced Cuba, both of which we handled, I think, very, very wisely and very well. Then we faced the June 67 war. Again, I think we handled very well. But in between this, the cities were burning. We had racial problems. We had riots in the cities. And Vietnam fitted in all of this, and we did not organize properly to deal with it. I think we organized admirably to deal with the nuclear danger in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it was a relatively simple thing to deal with it. It was a short period of time, a simple, narrow issue. We should have organized, I'll call it a war cabinet, Churchillian war cabinet, to deal with Vietnam. We didn't. That's one of the reasons we failed to address the questions you've outlined.
But Vietnam was a place where, you know, thousands and thousands of young Americans were dying. I guess it's a kind of frightening thought that you felt you were all just too busy, and that's one of the reasons why the war went the way that it did.
No, no, you're conveying a misimpression. It was that, my God, we were working, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But you were too busy to see more clearly is the point you're trying to make.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we were overwhelmed with problems, and we hadn't organized to segregate out from those people to work solely on Vietnam at the upper echelons of the government. And that's one of the lessons. And in the last chapter, I point to 11 lessons, of which that's one. For God's sakes, Mr. America, when you face military conflict, organize to deal with it effectively.
I want to get back to the peace movement for a second and ask you if this kind of behavior had any effect on you. You write in your memoir about how, after speaking to students at the Harvard Business School, a group of students surrounded your car and were shaking it. And I mean, you were surrounded and felt quite under attack. You were at the Seattle airport after climbing Mount Rainier, and a man came up to you and spit on you and called you a murderer. You're at a restaurant, a woman comes up to you and calls you a baby killer. What impact did that have on you?
Well, I relate all that in the book to emphasize that there were protests. And I was aware of them, as I've just outlined. My children were of the generation that was protesting. One of them was at Stanford, for example, and was involved in the protests there. I know you point to the protests at Harvard.
Let me focus my question a little bit more so you understand more of what I'm getting at.
No, I understand.
But allow me to just focus it a little more. I'm wondering if that kind of direct confrontation put you in a position of hardening yourself more against the protesters, whether that behavior reached you and made you think something wrong is happening here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was the latter. No, it didn't harden me. How could it harden me when I mentioned that my daughter brought protesters into the home, and when my son was associated with them in California? And as a matter of fact, I was meeting with one of the major protesters, a chaplain at Yale at the time, and I met with many others because I felt we had to stay in touch with them. And you haven't begun to deal with this issue of protest. Let me tell you something. It's in the book, and I hope your listeners will read it. A man, a Quaker, one of the finest human beings, his name was Morrison. He burned himself to death under my window in the Defense Department. And yesterday, now, so the first point I want to make is I was aware of the way people felt. I was aware of the problem. They didn't see the danger of Soviet communist aggression leading to the world war that Dean Rusk predicted would happen if we didn't save Vietnam. But yesterday, I received from the widow of Mr. Morrison, she's now remarried, her name is Ann Morrison Welch, a letter, and I want to read one paragraph. To heal the wounds of that war, we must forgive ourselves and each other and help the people of Vietnam to rebuild their country. I'm grateful to Robert McNamara for his courageous and honest reappraisal of the Vietnam War and his involvement in it. I hope his book will contribute to the healing process. She was a protester. He was a protester. She is a noble lady. She understands we should look back in retrospect. We should draw the lessons to try to prevent that from happening again.
I guess what I think a lot of people want to know is this. During the period when you had grave doubts about the war and 1,000 Americans a month were getting killed in that war, was it hard for you to not speak out publicly? And then also after you left the administration and the war continued for 7 more years and American casualties continued to mount up, if you had such grave doubts, how did you not manage to share them?
You misstate my position. It wasn't that I had, I'll call it, grave doubts about the war. I had grave doubts that we could win it militarily. And that is a major distinction. At the same time I had grave doubts about winning it militarily, I, along with my associates, believed that if we didn't prevent communist domination of Vietnam and use of that to obtain communist control of Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, we would be moving to a World War III. And therefore, what I had to do was reconcile this fear that we couldn't win militarily with the fear that if we just disengaged, we'd be on the way to World War III. And the way I brought those together in these memoranda of May 67 and November 67 was to say to the president, Mr. President, I don't think we can win militarily. We've got to use our military pressure as a basis for negotiation that will permit us to disengage militarily without leaving South Vietnam to communist control and the start of World War III. That was the basis.
Let me tell you something a friend said to me when she knew I was going to interview you. She said, "Oh, I bet he wrote this book because he knows he's going to meet his maker."
Look, when I meet my maker, the book isn't, he's not going to consider the book. The book was not written for redemption. Redemption is between me and my maker, and the book will have no influence on how he responds to that.
Robert McNamara, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you indeed.
Robert McNamara recorded in 1995 after the publication of his memoir. He died today at the age of 93. We're remembering Robert McNamara, who was considered the architect of the war in Vietnam. He died today at the age of 93. He served as Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. For many years, he wouldn't speak about his role in the war. That silence was broken by his 1995 memoir. In 2003, Errol Morris made a movie that tried to penetrate McNamara's enigmatic character. The movie was based on 20 hours of interviews with him, reflecting on the lessons he learned from Vietnam and World War II, in which he helped plan the firebombing of Tokyo. Morris's film, The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara, won an Academy Award. Before we hear the interview I recorded with Morris, here's a clip from the beginning of The Fog of War.
It's almost impossible for our people today to put themselves back into that period. In my 7 years as secretary, we came within a hair's breadth of war with the Soviet Union on 3 different occasions. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for 7 years as Secretary of Defense, I lived the Cold War. During the Kennedy administration, they designed a 100-megaton bomb. It was tested in the atmosphere. I remember this. Cold War? Hell, it was a hot war.
You know, one of the things that really astonished me watching The Fog of War was that McNamara was really lively, anecdotal, interesting, and I always thought of him, among other things, as cold and kind of inaccessible. In other words, that you'd never get anything out of him. give me an example of something he said that really surprised you.
Well, the most surprising thing was discovering that his role in Vietnam was different than I had thought. Remember, the Vietnam War was known to many people as McNamara's War. He became not only associated with the war, people thought of it as his war, as though he was the person primarily responsible for it. He was the hawk. He was the guy who pushed other people towards escalation, to bombing, to troops on the ground. You want an explanation for how we became mired in Vietnam? Look no further than Robert S. McNamara. And yet, as I got deeper and deeper into this story, my view of him and his role in history changed.
How did it change?
It changed in so many ways. I had read, in retrospect, in 1995, this was his supposed mea culpa for Vietnam.
His memoir.
His memoir. And what surprised me was the book I was reading was so different than the book I saw described in many, many reviews and editorials. Didn't seem to be a mea culpa at all. More this anguished attempt to go back into the past to try to figure out what happened and why it happened. There's this very odd conversation. The Fog of War actually has these recently released presidential recordings. Everybody knows Nixon made recordings. But it's less well known that Kennedy and Johnson recorded their conversations as well. Kennedy recorded cabinet meetings. Johnson recorded phone calls. So you can actually hear the President of the United States talking with McNamara. Front row seat in history, if you like. And there's one powerful conversation, October 2nd, 1963. This is less than 2 months before Kennedy was assassinated. We hear McNamara and the president talking, and McNamara is urging Kennedy to set a timetable, a schedule for getting out of Vietnam. This is the man who we consider to be the worst hawk of all in the administration, the most bellicose advisor of all in the administration.
It's tempting to kind of go over your whole film point by point and talk about all the points that Robert McNamara makes, but I think I should let our listeners see the movie and talk instead about how the movie was made. But first, I do want to just get to a couple of the very interesting points that McNamara makes in the movie. And one of them is in talking about World War II, where he served under General Curtis LeMay, and he participated in the planning of the firebombing of Tokyo, in which 100,000 civilians were killed. And he says something very interesting about war criminals. Why don't we hear this excerpt of your movie? This is an excerpt of Robert McNamara speaking in Errol Morris's documentary, The Fog of War.
I don't fault Truman for dropping the nuclear bomb. The U.S.-Japanese War was one of the most brutal wars in all of human history. kamikaze pilots, suicide, unbelievable. What one can criticize is that the human race prior to that time and today has not really grappled with what are, I'll call it, the rules of war. Was there a rule then that said you shouldn't bomb, shouldn't kill, shouldn't burn to death 100,000 civilians in a night? LeMay said, if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals. And I think he's right. He, and I'd say I, were behaving as war criminals.
Now, in talking about his role in Vietnam, he certainly gives the impression that he tried to talk President Johnson out of the war, tried to decreasing our presence in Vietnam. Do you believe that that was consistently his point of view with Johnson?
It's a tortured story. I believe that if Kennedy had lived, in all likelihood, there would not have been extensive bombing and 500,000 ground troops in Vietnam. It's one of those great mysteries that can't be really answered for certain. But the story leans in that direction. There is a considerable amount of evidence to suggest that's the case. One thing that's really interesting, I sometimes say, well, this revised story about Vietnam that emerges in the fog of war, it's not necessarily a better story. It's just a different story because it raises a whole set of different questions. If McNamara was opposed to the war, why did he become a part of its escalation? Why did he continue to serve Johnson if he disagreed with his policies? Why did he stay on until 1968? And why, when he left the administration, did he remain silent? The war went on 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, 74, 75. Between 2 and 3 million Vietnamese died, and 58,000 Americans.
Now, aren't these the questions that he still refuses to answer, the questions that you just raised?
Yes and no. The movie has an epilogue where I return to some of the central mysteries of this story. I feel that they're partial answers, but this is not a movie where every T can be crossed and every I dotted. There are mysteries that remain for me, having made the movie.
He reaches several conclusions and has several lessons that he feels like he's learned from his involvement in World War II and the Vietnam War. And one of his conclusions is you need to empathize with your enemy. But he says about Vietnam, we didn't know the Vietnamese well enough to empathize and put ourselves in their shoes. We saw the war in Vietnam as a Cold War. They saw it as a Civil War. And when I heard him say that, I thought, you know, what a true and interesting lesson to have learned and to impart to us. But then I thought for a second, isn't that what the anti-war movement was saying all along? That, you know, this isn't just the Cold War, this is a Civil War. Why are we involved there? I mean, isn't that something that people were shouting at him for years?
Yes. This is a movie with one interview, but sometimes I think they're actually two characters. The 85-year-old McNamara speaking to the 45-year-old McNamara. And one
yeah,
of the questions.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, that was my, as a viewer, that was my impression too. Yeah.
And one question that keeps coming up again and again, is this the same man? Are these two different men?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in one sense, of course they're not. But are they the same? And in what way are they different, if they are different? You're absolutely right. Many of the things that McNamara says could have come out of anti-war demonstrators. It could have been things that they said verbatim in 1965. People who really hate McNamara, and there are many, when they hear about the lessons, they say, why do we want to hear anything this man says? Shouldn't he remain silent? My answer is an emphatic no. He has been so much a part of history, and the stories that he tells about history are really interesting and important stories. And they're stories by a man who knows.
You know, you're talking about him being like the 85-year-old McNamara talking to the 40-year-old or 45-year-old McNamara. And I felt as a viewer that there were two versions of me watching the movie.
Really interesting.
Yeah, and I'll explain what I mean. Because, like, when he talks about...
By the way, it's also true in my case.
Oh, really? Really? Yeah. So
yes.
Well, let me give you my example. When I was watching the movie and he says things like, during the war in Vietnam, his family was so stressed out, his family got ulcers. I can't remember if he got ulcers, too. And that, you know, that his family was just, like, sickened by all of the stress. And one part of me thought, wow, that's really interesting that, that it was so stressful on your family. And that's a very kind of, that elicited a very sympathetic response from me. But then the other part of me was saying, well, I should think so. The whole country was divided by this war. The country was at war with itself. Americans were dying. Vietnamese were dying. So many lives of Americans were totally changed by the war.
America was totally changed.
Right.
By the war.
So in that sense, I'm saying, well, you know, sure you'd have ulcers. I mean, geez. So I just felt myself having this constant dialogue with myself about my reactions to him and what he was saying. Tell me about the dialogue you had with yourself making the movie.
Well, my feelings about Vietnam haven't changed over the years. I demonstrated against the war as a young student because I found the war appalling. And now, many, many years later, I still find it appalling. Sometimes I think, am I being too easy on McNamara? Other times I think, am I being too hard on him? One undeniable aspect of the man is that he produces these very, very strong feelings. And yet I feel privileged to have been able to talk to him and to make this movie. It's interesting. I started these interviews before 9/11. The first interview with McNamara was in May of 2001. I never thought that this would be a movie about now, that this would be a movie about today.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as I continued to work on the film, the themes, the stories, the history that McNamara describes became more and more and more relevant to what is going on in the world today.
Let's get back to our interview with Errol Morris about his documentary, The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara. McNamara died today at the age of 93. The former Secretary of Defense was considered the architect of the Vietnam War. You know, I interviewed McNamara in 95 after his memoir was published.
Uh-huh.
And, as I said, I've never seen him be as interesting and lively and anecdotal as in your movie. And when I interviewed him, I guess, all of my instincts were, ask him why he hasn't apologized if he knew all this in advance. Ask him if he thinks he owes an America an apology or an explanation. And I haven't listened back to the interview, but I think that's where I kept where I kept heading. And I'm wondering if your instinct was ever to do that yourself, because the movie isn't that. You're not saying, well, then apologize. You know, you're letting him speak, you're letting him tell his story, and a lot of interesting things emerge. And those things are very lively and attention getting. I mean, you want to hear it. And whether you end up completely believing it or not, you want to hear it. But was there ever an instinct in you saying, get him to apologize?
Sure. Absolutely.
But did you kind of suppress that and just like let him talk, or did you keep kind of getting back to that?
Did I kind of suppress it? I like the idea of suppressing it. Maybe. It's interesting because when you say there's something missing, if people say, well, McNamara didn't go as far as I would like, or McNamara really didn't apologize, or McNamara didn't really confess, I would ask myself, what is it that they want to hear? What exactly are they looking for? And I ask myself, do I want to hear McNamara apologize for the war? And here's my answer. Not really.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Because I don't think there is any apology for the war in this sense. How do you apologize for the death of 58,000 Americans and 2 to 3 million Vietnamese? I think he's done something far more interesting. He has gone back over the history of the war. Don't forget, this is the man who ordered the Pentagon Papers to be created. If you like, it's that same instinct to go back over the past, to look at it, to try to understand it. For the totally unsympathetic, the people who will hate McNamara no matter what, they will look at this attempt to go back over the past as excuse-making. Yeah, sure, he's going back over the past, but he's going over the past just to provide a gloss on the past, to make himself look better. My answer is no. When he suggests that he and LeMay were war criminals in World War II, and he tells a story that is so different from any other story I've heard about that period, I don't look at it as an attempt to whitewash the past, but as a sincere attempt to go back over the past, to think about the past.
Mm-hmm. Your interview with McNamara, as it is in the movie The Fog of War, starts with him having to pick up where he left off, I guess because like the tape or the film had run out, and he has to like pick up in the middle of the sentence. In fact, let me just play this little excerpt.
Now, I remember exactly the sentence I left off on. I remember how it started, and it was cut off in the middle, but you can fix it up some way. I don't want to go back introduce the sentence because I know exactly what I wanted to say.
Go ahead.
Okay. Any military commander who is honest with himself or with those he's speaking to will admit that he has made mistakes in the application of military power. He's killed people unnecessarily, his own troops or other troops, through mistakes, through errors of judgment. 100 or thousands or tens of thousands, maybe even 100,000. But he hasn't destroyed nations. And the conventional wisdom is don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from your mistakes. And we all do. Maybe we make the same mistake three times, but hopefully not four or five. There'll be no learning period with nuclear weapons. You make one mistake, you're going to destroy nations.
That's Robert McNamara in the very opening of The Fog of War, and my guest is the filmmaker, Errol Morris. You know how I was talking about how I had two reactions to a lot of the movie? I had two reactions to seeing this part of the interview, especially at the very beginning. Part of me said, well, he's being kind of manipulative here. He knows exactly what he's going to say. He's saying it. He's so kind of conscious of himself as an interviewee. But then the other part of me said, yes, he should be. He has something really important to say here about, you know, lessons about nuclear weapons and being, being in a position of power in the nuclear era. This is really important. I'm glad he remembered what he wanted to say. Tell me why you wanted to lead with this in a way, very self-conscious moment of him saying, I'm going to pick up exactly where I left off. I know what I want to say.
Well, among other things, he's a control freak.
Right.
And it's interesting to be reminded of that fact at the very beginning.
At the very
of the movie.
Beginning, yeah. Uh-huh.
In fact, we see at the very beginning of the movie, we see him in 1964 doing pretty much the same thing that he's doing in 2001.
Well, Errol Morris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Errol Morris recorded in 2004. His film about Robert McNamara is called The Fog of War. McNamara died today at the age of 93. Whether it's in Central Park, Stratford-upon-Avon, Stratford, Ontario, or at the open-air Globe Theatre in London, productions of Shakespeare are among the most popular summer events. But our classical music critic Lord Schwartz says you don't have to leave your house to see great Shakespearean acting and learn something about acting at the same time.
Nearly 25 years ago, I got a call from an old friend who was very excited about a British TV series called Playing Shakespeare that was airing in New York. It didn't make it to Boston, and probably not to most other places. But my friend recorded one of the episodes and sent me the tape. I was blown away. The host was director John Barton, co-founder of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the performers on that episode included Judi Dench. Nearly an hour was taken up with Barton going over a short scene, line by line, showing how crucial an understanding of Shakespeare's language and versification were to conveying the meaning and power of the scene. How rare it was to hear an intelligent discussion of literature and drama on television. Finally, a new label called Athena has just released a set of all 9 episodes of that 1984 series, and every one of them is a revelation. Among the actors participating in Barton's exploration of Shakespeare are Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, Ben Kingsley, David Suchet, who's probably more famous in this country as Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot than as a Shakespearean actor, and Dame Peggy Ashcroft in a rare television appearance. In each episode, they perform or recite a variety of scenes or passages from a Shakespeare play or poem. These British actors have honeyed tongues and impeccable diction. But then Barton starts asking them to think about what Shakespeare actually wrote, down to his meter and line breaks. Since the plays are written in verse, in a heightened language, should an actor make the performance more stylized or more naturalistic? What if one speech ends in the middle of a line of iambic pentameter, and another character continues where that line left off? Does that indicate a pause or a rush forward? It's also fascinating to watch two actors approach the same character. There's a memorable sequence in which both Patrick Stewart and David Suchet play Shylock. Suchet, who mentions that he is Jewish, feels that Shylock's Jewishness is central to the part. He plays the moneylender with a slightly Jewish inflection. Stewart, who isn't Jewish, feels the center of Shylock's character is his greed and downplays his Jewishness. Here's Stewart.
Well then, it now appears you need my help. Go to then. You come to me and you say, Shylock, we would have monies. You say so. You that did void your room upon my beard and foot me as you spur a stranger cur over your threshold. Monies is your suit. What should I say to you? Should I not say, have a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or should I bend low and in a bondman's key with bated breath and whispering humbleness say this? Oh, fair sir, you spat on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time you called me dog, and for these courtesies I'll lend you thus much monies.
Okay. And here's Suchet.
Well, then, it now appears you need my help. Go to, then. You come to me and you say, Shylock, we would have monies. You say so. You that did void your room upon my beard? And foot me as you spurn a stranger cur over your threshold. Money's is your suit. What should I say to you? Should I not say? Hath a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or shall I bend low and in a bondman's key with bated breath and whispering humbleness say this? Fair sir, you spat upon me Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time you called me dog. And for these courtesies, I'll lend you thus much monies.
Good.
Both actors resist the common temptation to sentimentalize Shylock. Maybe because Barton has directed both of them in this part before. They couldn't be more different, yet both of them still convey the same hurt, anger, and irony that are at the heart of this role. My favorite episode remains the one my friend sent me. It's a brief scene from Twelfth Night with Judi Dench as Viola, who is in love with the Duke Orsino, played by Richard Pascoe, but who has to hide her love because she's disguised as a boy. John Barton stops the actors at almost every line, and after every interruption, the characters and their motivations take on another new dimension. When we finally watch the scene all the way through, we're no longer watching acting. The actors have become almost transparent, and through them, it's the characters, the story, the action, the play that compel us. Here's a clip of the radiant final take of that scene from Twelfth Night.
My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should, your lordship.
And what's her history?
A blank, my lord. She never told her love. But let concealment, like a worm i' the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on the monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love, indeed? We men may say more, swear more, but indeed our shows are more than will. For still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love.
Died thy sister of her love, my boy?
I am all the daughters of my father's house. And all the brothers, too. And yet, I know not.
If you're interested in Shakespeare, in poetry or in theater, I think you'll be completely mesmerized by this series. And I'll leave the last wise, sensible words to John Barton.
Shakespeare is his text, and the way he uses it is just that. So if you want to do him justice, you have to look for and follow the clues he offers. If an actor does that, then he'll find that Shakespeare himself starts to direct him.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the 4-DVD set called Playing Shakespeare on the Athena label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.